from VOA Press Conference USA. Here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is VOA diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Frances Brown. She's a fellow with the Democracy, Conflict, and Governance Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and that's a prominent think tank here in Washington. Prior to joining Carnegie, Frances Brown served for 18 months as Director for Democracy on the White House National Security Council staff under both the Obama and Trump administrations, where she helped manage policy processes on key political transitions, post-conflict stabilization efforts, and democracy support. Frances also spent 5 years working at the U.S. Agency for International Development's Office of Transition Initiatives, managing stabilization and political transition programs in Afghanistan, the Middle East, and Africa, from the field and Washington. Her writing focuses on conflict, governance, and U.S. foreign policy, and she has published field research projects on Afghanistan stabilization and subnational governance with the U.S. Institute of Peace, and shorter analyses for many reputable news outlets. Well, we're delighted that Frances Brown could join us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington to draw on her vast foreign policy and national security experience to shed light on a number of pressing issues facing the United States and the world. Frances Brown, welcome to the program.
Delighted to be here. Thanks so much.
And I'm delighted, as always, to welcome my colleague, Cindy Sain, our diplomatic correspondent.
My pleasure.
Frances, you served on the White House National Security Council for both Obama and the Trump administrations. How would you compare and contrast your experiences between these two administrations? What were the points of convergence and divergence from your experience?
Well, Carol, I think what I learned from my experience on both the Obama White House staff and then the Trump White House staff was really how these two presidents approached foreign policy very differently and how that trickled down to me and my colleagues as staffers. So in the Obama White House, President Obama made it very clear that we were all a team trying to solve problems for the American people. So big problems that were facing us in the foreign policy arena were issues like climate change, issues like the rise of ISIS, issues like looking at a rising China and figuring out alternatives, and ending wars. And the way we approached our job then was trying to all work together to marshal all the parts of the U.S. government, the State Department, the Defense Department, the Treasury Department, many other actors, to try to solve these problems in partnership with allies. I talk about in a Washington Post piece I wrote recently how we spoke almost entirely in sports metaphors because we thought of ourselves as that team. In U.S. football parlance, we were trying to move the ball down the field. That might not make too much sense for our international viewers. We were trying to put points on the board. So it was a really hardworking, team-oriented approach to public service. When the Trump administration came in, I did stay on. I was a civil servant in the White House, so I was there through all of the transition and then the first 8 months of the Trump administration. What I learned is that the Trump team viewed public service very differently, and they viewed foreign policy very differently. As we all know, President Trump is the businessman in chief, and he viewed foreign policy in terms of getting a good deal or a bad deal, that it was America versus the world. He didn't think as much in terms of alliances or partnerships. He thought that the rest of the world was trying to get a bad deal for America. The other really important thing I learned as a Trump NSC staffer was that for all of my work and my colleagues' work to get the words exactly right, to write the exact right talking points for the president to use, to make communications very clear. In the Trump administration, speaking clearly didn't matter as much. The president kind of liked to be ambiguous about what he was doing with regards to China, what he was doing with regards to Russia, what his policy intentions were for Syria. Whereas in a normal administration, Republican or Democrat, the White House would really strive to be clear in its objectives. In the Trump administration, that was basically flipped on its head. And I think we're seeing that still more in recent foreign policy episodes that we can get into.
I have a quick follow-up before I turn to my colleague Cindy. Now, of course, President Trump makes no secret of his sort of disdain for public servants. of course, to the dismay of those of us who are public servants who work for the government. But let's look at a recent example with regard to the impeachment hearings that we've witnessed over the last weeks. Even though the White House sought to block testimonies by executive branch officials during the impeachment inquiry, many senior Foreign Service and national security officials responded to congressional subpoenas and dutifully testified about what they saw, heard, or experienced with regard to the Ukraine scandal at the heart of the impeachment inquiry. And some of their testimonies may actually implicate the president and other cabinet officials. And of course, as a result, President Trump and some Republicans have disparaged those public servants. President Trump even live tweeted during the testimony of former ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, who was abruptly recalled from her post after a smear campaign by President Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani. Are you concerned, Francis, about the effect of these actions and these denigrating remarks on our professional diplomats and civil servants? You know, the ability for them to continue to do their jobs without intimidation and the ability to even recruit new officers to replenish the ranks of so many who are leaving, and the fact that President Trump and senior national security officials are showing the interest in cutting even more staff from the National Security Council.
Yeah, I find it tremendously troubling, Carol. I think exactly as you say, we are seeing the president almost going to war with the public servants who are meant to be filling out his policies and carrying out his policies. I think what we saw during the impeachment hearings was the tremendous skill on display of these public servants, the patriotism, the articulate ideas about how the U.S. should advance national interests. These were apolitical civil servants, for the most part, who simply wanted to advance U.S. policy. And instead, as you know, we had the president oftentimes by name calling out these civil servants as his enemies. I think it's already, unfortunately, having a real chilling effect on the Foreign Service, on the civil service. We've seen, I believe, historic lows of people taking the Foreign Service exam to get into the State Department. We've seen record number of senior diplomats retiring. So there's a very real chilling effect and a very real hollowing out. And honestly, I think even if a new president were to come in, either in 1 year or in 5 years, some of this damage is going to be very hard to undo for the U.S. public servants and the U.S. diplomatic corps. My colleague Bill Burns at the Carnegie Endowment has written about this exact hollowing out of the diplomatic corps, and I think he makes several excellent points about the real jeopardy that this places U.S. national interests in.
Indeed, because what happens is the rift between the administration and our professional civil and foreign service sends a mixed message to our allies and adversaries. They don't know who's speaking for whom.
Exactly. And I think that's been in full display as regards Ukraine. What we've learned now is that we've got almost two parallel foreign policies that were underway with regards to Ukraine. We had the foreign policy that was being advanced by the Defense Department, the State Department, the Treasury Department, all really in lockstep and saying we should be giving security assistance to Ukraine because it's in a war with Russia. This is in U.S. national interest. This isn't altruism. This is the right thing to do for U.S. national interests. So that was one foreign policy. And then in parallel, we had a separate foreign policy being run by the president, his lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, and other of their colleagues. And as you say, the messaging for our allies and partners was tremendously confusing and damaging.
I'd like to turn to Cindy Sain for a question.
Yes, since you have been working for both administrations, a number of observers have said that it would seem that President Trump seems to have a real affinity for dictators or authoritarian leaders. Have you noticed that yourself, and especially with your focus on U.S. support for democracy, have you noticed a substantive change between the two administrations?
Yeah, it is a really notable trend in the Trump administration and with President Trump himself. He does have a marked and kind of puzzling affinity for strongman leaders, for usually guys who he can buddy up with and talk tough with. And we've seen this with regard to a number of leaders. We've seen it with Vladimir Putin. We've seen it with the Turkish leader, Erdogan. We've seen it with the Filipino leader, Duterte. These are all strongman leaders who are not democratic reformers. And I do think this sends a very strong message. Again, in a traditional U.S. administration, Republican or Democrat, the president would send a really strong message in terms of abiding by democratic norms, not tolerating anti-democratic behavior. With Trump, we've seen pretty much the opposite. I don't have an explanation for that. I think a lot of it has to do with his own personal chemistry with these individuals. But I do think it has really detrimental effects for the U.S.'s policy priority of advancing democracy worldwide. And what we're seeing is that we've got the president on one level giving Oval Office meetings to these dictators and strongmen, at the same time as we've got the State Department and other U.S. public servants trying to stand up for democracy around the world, ambassadors around the world telling their counterparts, you need to abide by human rights norms, you need to have free and fair elections. So once again, you've got this tension within the U.S. foreign policy apparatus, and it's really detrimental. It's really confusing.
Right. You mentioned the tension between the U.S. foreign policy apparatus. We've also seen some clashes between the White House and Congress. And you mentioned President Trump's close relation with Turkey's President Erdogan. And Congress is threatening to impose sanctions against Turkey. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Congress has been really trying to advance a pretty hard line against Turkey. They actually already passed one set of sanctions within the past year. At the same time, Trump has sort of developed this very warm chemistry with President Erdogan. As you know, he just visited the White House this autumn. So Erdogan is getting very mixed messages. The challenge when you've got, again, the two different branches of government doing two different foreign policy is that if Congress passes sanctions, it still needs the executive branch to fulfill those sanctions, to carry out those sanctions. And there's a lot of ways in which the Trump administration cannot carry those out. So we could see a scenario where Congress continues to make strong statements and pass strong legislation and it not actually get anywhere.
We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Frances Brown. She's a fellow with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace's Democracy, Conflict, and Governance program. She was formerly director for democracy on the White House National Security Staff under the Obama and Trump administrations. I'm Carol Castiel, along with VOA diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. And a new VOA English app for both Android and Apple devices has been developed, and we encourage you to download and use them. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Here's a shout out to a loyal fan, Shedrock Alicia Dabang. He's from Plateau State, Nigeria. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our special guest, Frances Brown. And Frances, I want to go back and talk a little bit more about what's going on with this Ukraine scandal and the impeachment inquiry. There's a lot of talk about, you know, making conditions on foreign aid. And what President Trump did is no different than what other White Houses do. But some people say there is a distinction. Can you discuss the difference between the normal conditioning of foreign aid on compliance with established foreign policy goals and the so-called conditions that Mr. Trump allegedly requested of Ukraine in return for receipt of disbursement of already congressionally approved military aid?
Absolutely, because I think this is an essential distinction for our listeners to understand. The United States often puts conditions on foreign aid, be it security aid or other forms of economic assistance, in order to advance policies that the U.S. sees in its national interests. That's very normal and very appropriate. So in many cases, if in the Ukraine case, there were particular corruption benchmarks that had been laid out that we wanted the Ukrainians to follow through on as a policy decision, conditioning aid on that would have been a fairly normal scenario. The difference in what we have learned has happened in this instance is that this aid wasn't being conditioned on a U.S. policy objective, like fighting corruption. Instead, it was being conditioned on the president's own personal and political objectives of getting the Ukrainians to conduct an investigation into one of the president's own domestic political opponents, Joe Biden and Joe Biden's family. That's a tremendously important distinction, and we need to never forget that there's a difference between U.S. policy goals on one side and the president's own personal agenda on the other.
Turning to Syria, if we may, now the Pentagon is saying that U.S. troops are taking part in raids against ISIS in Syria with Kurdish allies again, just a couple of weeks after President Trump said that he's withdrawing American forces. Can you explain U.S. policy towards Syria at the moment? And what impact do these shifts in policy have on allies and others?
U.S. Syria policy over the past year, it hasn't just been a flip-flop. I would say it's been a flip-flop, flip-flop, flip. And I think we've now just gotten to the final flop. So we have had U.S. troops partnering with local forces known as the Syrian Democratic Forces for over 2 years, taking the fight to counter ISIS. And this has been a militarily very successful campaign. We saw the final bit of the territorial caliphate under ISIS fall earlier this year. So it was a tremendously successful military campaign. However, that partnership has always been a partnership that Turkish President Erdogan has had problems with. As we mentioned, Turkish President Erdogan and President Trump have a very close relationship. And Turkish President Erdogan has some legitimate concerns about the SDF as being connected to a terrorist group that has operated on Turkish soil. So this has always been in tension. What we've seen in this flip-flop, flip-flop is that President Trump has alternatively said he was taking U.S. forces out of Syria and then allowed them to go back in. We saw this first in December of last year, and then we've seen this more recently. The final upshot of this most recent turnabout that's happened this autumn was that, as you say, President Trump announced all U.S. troops were leaving in early October. U.S. troops did exit for the most part, but have slowly made their way back and are now conducting the same counter-ISIS operations as they were before. You could say, so then what's changed? We had a little blip, but unfortunately a lot has changed and there has been some impact on U.S. interests. So first of all, as the U.S. abruptly withdrew, we gave up a lot of the territory that we'd been holding in Syria, and we gave it up to Russians as well as the Syrian regime. So the Russians are now literally inhabiting the bases where U.S. troops used to be stationed in Syria. In addition, the counter-ISIS campaign, which was our major objective, was slowed down considerably because we took our eye off the ball. And then finally, the partnership that we did have with the Syrian Democratic Forces has really been frayed. Many civilians and troops were killed or displaced in the process. So the U.S. has given up a lot by this most recent flip-flop without getting much in return. We've now got a smaller area of operations from which we are conducting these campaigns. There is also now an oil protection mission that President Trump has said is part of this mission, which again raises all kinds of legal questions as well as policy questions.
Let's turn now to Afghanistan, Francis, where you also have quite a bit of experience and background. This is the longest war that the United States has been engaged in, and we're still not at the point where there's a peace deal with the Taliban, between the government and the Taliban. I'd like to get your observations and recommendations regarding the next steps to engage in this kind of peace negotiations with the Taliban, making sure that the country will never again be a launching pad for international terrorist attacks like the one we experienced on 9/11, but at the same time, ensuring that the country is on its way to self-sufficiency, whether economically, politically. How do you see what the next step should be, both for the United States and for Afghanistan?
So to take one step back, I would say that the Trump administration deserves some credit with regards to Afghanistan because they did recognize we need to bring this war to an end and we need to take some different approaches to bringing about negotiations to bring the war to an end. So about a year ago, we saw the Trump administration empower a special envoy, an Afghan-American named Zalmay Khalilzad, who really turbocharged the negotiation effort with the Taliban to try to meet these U.S. objectives. So he worked very hard for a year to try to come up with a deal between the U.S. and the Taliban to get at some of these core objectives. So from the U.S. side, we want to make sure that Afghanistan is never again used as a harbor for terrorist attacks on us or our allies. And from the Taliban side, they want U.S. troops to leave. Additionally, from the U.S. side, we have a couple other things that we would like to see at some point soon. One is a ceasefire. The level of violence is catastrophic in Afghanistan. Afghan civilians and Afghan security forces are the ones who are bearing the brunt of this, but it's devastating levels of deaths this year and then last year. We also, on the U.S. side, would like to see the Afghan government included in negotiations, Afghan civil society included in negotiations, Afghan political opposition included in negotiations. We'd like to see what we call an intra-Afghan dialogue. And I think those have to be the next steps. So, as I said, the Trump administration gets a lot of credit for starting down this long path. Unfortunately, what we saw earlier this autumn in September was that President Trump sort of put the brakes abruptly on that negotiation process, and it's been stalled for some time. In more recent weeks, we've seen some signs that this negotiation may be getting back on track. We've seen a prisoner exchange. The Taliban decided to release two Western prisoners that they'd been holding, two professors, whereas the Afghan government released some of the Taliban's prisoners. So that could be a show of faith on both sides to restart negotiations, but we'll have to see. My recommendation is that we do need to restart these talks with all urgency. There will not be a perfect solution for Afghanistan, but the current status quo is worse for the Afghan people most of all.
Another area in which you also have quite a bit of experience, the Middle East, the Levant, we're seeing incredible protests in Lebanon and Iraq, an outpouring of a cross-section of sects and ethnicities, basically protesting against the political and economic elites. Iran has been a major target in both Iraq and Lebanon. They're railing against Iran's outsized influence. They're protesting against the lack of economic opportunities and the corruption. How do you see these protests, Francis? Do you see a positive trend? It must be heartening to see this outpouring of democratic desires, but at the same time, it's unstable.
In both Lebanon and Iraq, I think we've seen some heartening trends and then also some troubling ones. Although these protests were caused by local or national issues, they did have some commonalities, as you say. They were driven by a sense across the population that the system was rigged. We've heard that before. The system was rigged, that political elites were corrupt and were not making reforms that would help the average Lebanese or the average Iraqi. Oftentimes, they were prompted by economic issues. In Lebanon, the government announced a tax on WhatsApp, the messaging app, which was the precipitating cause. But the reason for the protests went much deeper than that. In the Lebanon context, it was also particularly heartening to see Lebanese across their many confessions, their many sects, protesting. This wasn't just one group or another. However, I see a really troubling trend, which is that both of these protests or the response has turned violent in both cases. We've seen over 300 Iraqis killed by security forces. In Lebanon, in more recent days, we've seen violent clashes between protesters and the Hezbollah movement. So that's a very worrying trend. The other big question is, how do these protests be resolved? These protests are largely leaderless. They're grassroots organic, which makes them very powerful, but also makes it very hard to figure out a response that will satiate the protesters' demands. In both Lebanon and Iraq, the protesters are basically saying some version of throw the whole system out, overturn the whole system. And that's a very hard thing for a government to do, probably to the degree to which the protesters want. So my concern is that we might see these protests and escalating levels of violence continue for a very long time without resolution.
Quickly, a follow-up, Francis. How do you see the role of the United States with regard to these protests? And what is the U.S. policy in your view? For example, I was wondering, these protests, the outpouring of the desire for greater democracy and quality, that should be a good thing for the United States. It should bode well as this anti-Iran sentiment.
Absolutely. Those two demands are certainly in line with U.S. policy priorities. At the same time, I think any U.S. administration would be wary of getting too involved because, as you know, there's a deep legacy of U.S. involvement on behalf of democracy in the Middle East. And there's a sense in these countries that these are internal issues and that they're better addressed on the inside. I think the U.S. can be a strong voice for nonviolence on the outside, and if requested, provide technical assistance, restructuring. If Lebanon wants a new electoral law and would like some technical assistance, that would certainly be appropriate for the U.S. to provide. But I think any U.S. administration would be wary of seeming to wade too deeply into these issues.
That's a very good point.
This may be an unfair question with all the complexities that we've been discussing, but looking ahead to the new year, to 2020, what do you think might be the most urgent foreign policy challenge the U.S. is facing?
I'd say the U.S. has two urgent foreign policy issues that we haven't even touched on yet. One is, how do we deal with a rising China? How do we both compete in the areas where we need to compete, cooperate in the areas in which we have common interests, and have a very nuanced policy towards China? I think we've sort of been addressing China as either the bogeyman on economic issues or turning a blind eye on some of its human rights violations, without, at least in my view, having a really comprehensive and nuanced policy. So I think that is urgent number one. Urgent foreign policy issue number two is climate change. It is a global issue. It affects us here at home and overseas. It affects our economy. And that's one where I don't think we've seen the Trump administration show leadership, quite the contrary. I will add a third. Third is finally ending all of these wars, or bringing these wars to a close, be it Syria or Afghanistan, the unrest in Iraq. These are issues that continue to demand our attention because the human fallout is massive. The fallout for U.S. interests is massive. So we need to continue working on those.
And to close, Frances, I just want to bring us back to the beginning when we were talking about Ukraine and the impeachment inquiry. Let's just talk basically about, why does Ukraine matter, not just because it's at the heart of this impeachment inquiry, but there are major national security and geostrategic implications, because I'm referring to the international ramifications of the United States appearing at least to side with Russia, which is the aggressor. And then we're seeing even this false narrative that Ukraine, not Russia, is guilty of hacking the Democratic National Committee and interfering in our 2016 elections. Russia is surely benefiting from this scandal, and it shows that senior members of the U.S. administration were wavering in their support for our ally Ukraine. And that, of course, is just music to the ears of Vladimir Putin, who wants to bring Ukraine back into the Russian orbit. But that's really antithetical, not just to U.S. interests, but also to Ukraine. It wants to be independent. There's a majority who want a more Western orientation, greater democracy, to rid themselves of corruption. So talk about the implications of that and why that's also very dangerous.
Yeah, Ukraine is tremendously important for U.S. foreign policy interests. As you say, it's essentially caught in the middle between the Russian sphere of influence on one side and Western democracies on another. It's literally in the middle geographically. It's literally in the middle in terms of policy influence. It's an emerging, nascent democracy that is trying to assert independence. At the same time, we've seen Russia wage war on it, so it's very much in the front lines. I think what happens in Ukraine is also important for U.S. interests because it sends a message about how the U.S. will stand behind or not stand behind our allies, our emerging democracy partners who want to stand up to Russia and want to be independent. And I think a lot of U.S. partners and allies are watching closely what happens in this instance. And it has great significance for what we'll see in the years to come.
Frances Brown is a scholar with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and she is formerly a White House National Security Staffer under the Obama and Trump administrations. Frances, thanks so much for coming in and sharing your deep insights on so many critical issues.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Kim Lewis for booking our guest. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. And joining me on the program was VOA diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain. I'm Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.